All the time is that you say you're going to say Los Angeles and San Francisco. So you get yourself meditatively quiet and into it because you really want to share the clearest space you've got, and you go in and you do Los Angeles. Then you finish Los Angeles, you got so much energy because you're playing with a tremendous, I mean, rock and roll stars, they all know it. You're just playing with an incredible amount of energy. And most of the time when I finish a lecture, I'm not in my body at all. And I'm out of time completely, and I can just sort of hang out forever. And the way what happens is, in the course of the next day, traveling to San Francisco or the motel, we go back usually and we look at television, and we eat something to bring us down. You got to come back into your body, you see. And the way we come back brings us so down in that the next day you got to climb up again, you know. And you end up, it's like this all the time, and you start to get wiped out. You're exhausted. And what I'd like to do is sort of like go out of my body at the beginning and not come back till the tour is all over by just sort of having the whole thing, because what I've been doing is traveling in my van now, and it's like a speed control thing, on the cruise control on my car. And I set the cruise control at 55, and I sit cross-legged in the driver's seat. Right? On these big superhighways going west, you know, and I have this incredible sound system. Oh, it is breathtaking. And I put this music on behind my head, and I sit there just doing following my breath, and I keep just enough consciousness on the physical plane to keep one finger on the steering wheel and keep oriented to keep the car moving, you know. And I just float, and my only new problem is now the country isn't big enough. See, I'm running out of country because I get into such ecstasy driving, I don't want to stop, you know. It's just incredible. I'm just floating through the countryside. And I'm not even smoking dope. I mean, it's just... So I would like now... But the problem is that hanging out brings me down. It really does. Because when you're with people, all of whom have this sadhana going, it's very hard, unless you immediately go back to reading holy books or whatever you do together, which you do now and then. But usually the level at which you hang out is kind of, it's back in your personality a lot. And I really feel, I don't mean literally staying out of my body all the time, because it's not that melodramatic. It just means staying in a clear consciousness during the tour. And I think then there won't be energy wasted, and there won't be a wipeout during the tour. That's what I'd like to see. If I could come out of a tour joyful and light, happy. And Jai is a good person to work with, because Jai spends most of his time just singing to God. I mean, he's really a pure and beautiful being. And Lakshmi, who's his wife, is an artist, and they're really living life beautifully and gently. And I'm going to build a whole crew that is like that. And I'm making decisions not to use a lot of people who would be more flashy, you know, in terms of the showbiz quality of it. But I'll have to live with all the rest of the time, because I've never traveled with a road group before. I've always done it alone, see. I've always hated it to be with other people. I mean, I always want to have a motel room and go in and close the door and, you know. And now I'd like to see whether we could do this and rent a bus or whatever we need to do it. And I'm thinking of, we had been talking today about, like, Jai had some beautiful instruments. He's got about 8 or 9 different musical instruments. And, it's got one exquisite one. It's got no names. A student made for him in Santa Cruz. It's just a beautiful, huge gourd with tennis racket strings and stuff like that. He plays beautiful music. And he started to play the music, and then he'd stop. And then I was reading the Maharaji stories, and I'd read a story. And then he'd play, and then I'd read a story. And I started to see how we were going to do this. And I'm going to have we're going to have our own sound system. And I'm going to have a control box right there. And he'll play the sarod or whatever, and then every now and then there'll just be voiceover, and then the music will come back, and we'll just kind of weave together for a while. And I'm thinking about also using slides of Anandamayi Maharaji and mandalas and things like that. And I'd like to read from Kabir and read little sections from Ramayana and stuff like that. I really like to share a space with people that focuses not necessarily on me, but focuses on process and isn't quite as much. I don't know yet how much I can deviate from people's expectations of what an evening with me is about, which is a lot of the kind of, you know, a big hoedown type thing, you know. And so there has to be some of that in there, I think. although, because I don't really, I'm not ready to be Krishnamurti yet. You know, I'm almost ready, but I'm not quite, you know.
I was going to say, that's the model. I just was coming to that.
So it's going to be a multimedia roadshow. Certainly something.
We've been calling the national, the church in Washington, the beautiful big church in Washington, you know, whatever that's. Cathedral.
Conception.
No, the cathedral, the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. See if we can get that. The television would make that much simpler, you know, because I can just be somewhere very quietly. And just because there's an awful lot of slippage in a system like a road thing.
Yeah.
In terms of the amount of stuff that it requires. But it also feeds financially all the projects that are going on at the Hanuman Foundation, which is nice.
You've mentioned the guru-disciple relationship, and yet you yourself have avoided assuming the position of a guru to others. Is there a reason for that? It's obviously been intentional, so there must be a reason for it.
What's a guru?
A teacher that you're implying there's a direct connection with.
I think I'm a vehicle for transmission. I think I'm a vehicle for transmission. That's what it is, I think. That's what it's about. I am not somebody who's interested in taking on everybody's karma. I don't want students. I don't want disciples. Maharaji had none. Why should I? I mean, he didn't tell me. He told me not to have it. He said, no ashrams, no monasteries. I don't want an institution. I don't want a game. I don't want people who can cop out saying, well, he's doing it for me. I want to keep throwing it back on everybody. They got to do it for themselves. However, there is a process that goes on between me and people, but it doesn't require a personal anything. It can happen over tapes. It could happen over television. It's something that has to do with the nature of my being. And the vibratory rate, if you will, of my being. And what it does is it resonates in something in another person, and it allows that thing to be activated, if you will, or to start happening. And then they can do all the rest on their own. And it takes a split second, is what it takes. For some people, they got to go through the paranoia and open slowly. But what they find out is I don't want anything from them. I do love them. Not in the love, interpersonal love sense, but I am in a love relationship with other beings, and I don't want anything, and I have compassion for their predicament. Really, that's it, you know? I mean, I don't know much more than anybody else knows. I don't know as much about a lot of stuff. I really don't know a lot. I'm not a scholar in that sense. You know, I'm not even a scholar of Hinduism. But this vibratory rate, that's just this feeling, this presence, this meeting of the space between beings. And the words that I talk aren't what it's about. It's known in Hinduism as the gift of Saraswati. And it has to do with the fifth chakra. It's the open fifth chakra. And in the quality of the fifth chakra is that you turn totally towards God. You turn towards God. It's an inward turning. And at the same moment, it's the gift of the voice, right? And that's what it is. That was the blessing. That was the boon, if you will, all right? And so the voice and the eyes both transmit something. Certainly my body doesn't. It's just a, you know, 46-year-old body. But the rest of it transmits something. Like with Maharaji, every part of him transmitted it. I mean, we'd spent hours just discussing his foot. I mean, in ecstasy, if you, you know. And that I don't think is about to happen with me. You know, I'm manicuring my nails in case it should happen, but I... But it feels to me like that thing is available to people without all the falderall of joining or discipleship. Now, it is true that when I work with an individual, my detachment, or whatever that space is, does allow me to see a lot of this stuff quickly and clean up and point out. But they can do that too, and I can only do a certain amount of that. I mean, there's just many more people that would like that than is available, because, and it may well be, I'll figure out how to do it. I mean, in the past, when I work with an individual, I might sit with the same person anywhere from 3 to 7 hours with eye contact. Just cleaning, going and waiting until they let go, and they let go, and they let go, until we're just here, and there's just nothing that anybody's holding on to. It's just all right here, out open. And then what happens is we move into planes of light together, and it's just blinding. It's just incredible. And I can withstand it. I can just sit with it. And they go through all the changes of it, and then pretty soon we're just here, and we're just these... We're not on the physical plane. We are also, but we are... Just light bodies meeting. It's just a very clear, quiet, present space. I'm not convinced that has to happen on a one-to-one basis. And I also would like to experiment, like in television, with looking directly into the eye of the camera and doing the same process on television. I'd like to guide a meditation where I look right at the person and just do it. And I think the whole process can go on quite independent of these old models we have of how it's... I got to have a guru and he's got to know my name and he's got to know where I'm at and so on. I had students in New York. Joya made me have students. And I had students for a year, which I'd never had before. I mean, I had class, a continuing class. I run an ashram for 2 weeks, but this was a year thing. And it was extraordinary where we got to. I mean, that was incredible stuff that happened in that class. And when I stopped the class, everybody was freaking that I was stopping. A year later, when I came back and met most of them in one lifetime or one way or another, the absence of me, they were stronger than they had been when I was around. They were growing beautifully. A lot of them had gone on to other teachers, and it was just beautiful. Right? So that freed me a lot from the feeling of guilt of walking out on people.
You've held tight to Maharaji. You haven't moved on to another living teacher. Do you suggest that for everyone? Once they find their teacher.
I remember when I was at Muktananda's ashram, and they were being very kind to me, and Muktananda was a beautiful guy, and there was a lot of power there, and I was being treated very royally. And, what was her name? Papa's sister, Amma, who was sort of been with Muktananda for many years, took me into a room, and she said, "You know, really, Muktananda's your guru. And you really should acknowledge that." I mean, she said, "Maharaji is a great siddha, but he's not, you know, he was good for the beginning, but now, for this stage, Muktananda is your guru, and, you know, we all know it, you should acknowledge it." And I looked in my heart, and I saw that the level at which one chooses gurus has nothing whatsoever to do with decision making. It is just totally irrelevant. I could say my guru was Ada Ima Amen, you know. I mean, it's totally irrelevant. My mind has nothing to do with it. The relation of guru and chela. I mean, Maharaji never acknowledged me as his chela. He never admitted he was a guru to anybody. Okay, so I don't know that he's my guru. Right? He always told me everybody. He told me Mayor Baba was my guru. He told me Muktananda. He told me all these people were my guru. Right? He'd get rid of me in a second. He was always throwing me out to somebody else. But because he knew the thing was such a lock-in at the heart space, there wasn't any. It was totally irrelevant, you know, what I thought it was. So I don't really know what it's about. I don't have any choice. All I know is it consumes me completely. And I know also an interesting thing, that there is a transformation occurring now in which my Ishtadev, or my connection, my spiritual form of connection, as long as I still use forms, which I only do and don't do, really, moves now more from Maharaji to Hanuman. And that Hanuman's becoming a much more real guiding entity for me now than prior to this. And I'm watching this process with fascination, because they're the same person, they're the same being, they're just in different forms. And I also know the whole trivia of form. I mean, I've told the story about how Maharaji really freed me when I was sitting across from the courtyard from him. You know that's the story about that? You look dense like you don't know, so I'll tell you. Yes, you do. I must have written it somewhere, huh?
From London.
I was sitting across the courtyard from him. It was near the end of the time I was with him before he left his body, before I left India. And everybody was over rubbing his feet, and I was watching from the other side of the courtyard, and I thought, what's all that about? I don't want to do that. That's not what it's about. I don't want a guru that way. I was just sitting there feeling guilty for not wanting to rush over and touch his feet. You know, I loved him so much, and yet I saw that the apples, the throwing of the apples and all that stuff was like a veil, you know, and I didn't want the veil anymore. I said, I don't even care if I never see him again. You know, and it was like a heresy, a heretic thought that I was having sitting over there. And at that moment, Maharaji turned and whispered to an old Indian devotee who ran across the courtyard, ran, and came up to me and touched my feet. And I pranamed and I said, why did you do that? He said, Maharaji said, go quick, touch Ram Dass's feet. He and I understand each other perfectly. And that had never happened before, and it never happened after that. And as far as I'm concerned, Maharaji was saying to me, you're right on, baby. Don't get caught in that stuff at all. Yeah. And I've listened to that, you know, so that I have Maharaji and he has me, and I never want to be had by anybody else. But I take teachings from, you know, I'm a teaching whore. I'll take teachings from anybody that's got a teaching. I don't care, you know. I'm on the make for, you know, for any little corners I can clean up. So you tell me now, what are my corners that you're holding on to? I heard you before. You're not getting away. Come on, it's on tape. It's right on the radio. Come on there now, Will. Teach me. Come on, tell me what work I got to do. What do you hear? You guys are professional listeners to all these people who come around doing this trip. What do you hear now? What do you hear?
I hear that a variety of people need a variety of paths, really. I seem to feel more as you do than I do as others do. What you're expressing. I do see those things as potential traps, at least as, if not a trap, at least a transitional phase. And it seems as though what you're expressing, you're doing in moving toward Hanuman, is one step closer to formlessness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a definite progression even there.
Mm.
And that feels good. To my being, that feels like the proper direction to move.
I could actually live in the, not live in, that is what I mean, but I could actually work with the systems in which there is no form that is used as a vehicle. There's just method, but there's no form. But I am wary of them because of what I experience as the imbalance of the heart and the head. That most techniques of Dhyan and Jnana yoga seem to me to not have the flow of love open enough. We also see that the focus on the love per se gets awfully romanticized and undisciplined and lost in the shuffle too. But the balance act is what I feel very strongly, and it's what Gurdjieff talked about the balance of the heart, head, and the body, you know. And like I will go, for example, now for a week with Kalu Rinpoche, who is a, oh boy, I mean, he's like a piece of old parchment. He's just beautiful. He's hardly there at all, and he's delicious, and he's light, and he's a great master. There's no doubt about it. He's a great master. And I will sit with him, not because I'm going to become a Tibetan Buddhist. I'm not interested in taking vows or anything. All I know is that he's a beautiful being to be around, and I'd like to sit and meditate with him. And if he speaks, I'd like to be in his vibratory space. And when he talks about stuff, I'll listen, and it'll run through my consciousness in relation to everything else I've got going, and it may or may not be relevant. I have no idea. And yet, when I'm with him, I see, though his heart is quite beautiful, the method itself doesn't work until very evolved stages with the hearts of others. With Trungpa, it's not as clear that his heart is as open as I think it ought to be. I mean, if Trungpa has one failing, it may be that his compassion is too head-trippy, and that it's not, he's too much of a jnana yogi in that sense, and the other quality, or it may be that that's the mask. You never know, you know, but and the way we polarized in 74 when we both taught at Naropa was really head and heart, right? And I think both of us thought it was a shuck, really, you know, because I know he's got a heart and he knows I got a head. I mean, that's, so it's not really a fair polarity. But I don't find that balance very often. Balance very often. Like next summer, this is an interesting thing. I've just been through quite a round with Lama, the Lama Foundation. Lama's a commune, I guess you know, in New Mexico, north of Taos. And I've been involved with it as sort of a spiritual friend, Metta Kalyana, for many years now, since before its inception. Steve and Barbara and I lived together in Los Altos in a farm, and we planned a lot of this stuff that came out as Lama. And Steve Durkee, who was really, has a tremendous life force, very strong fellow, and Barbara, his wife, who was also an extremely strong person. He's an artist, a beautiful mandala artist. He did the cover of Be Here Now. He did the layout of Be Here Now. Right? He didn't do the artwork, all of it, but he did the layout of it. And the square book and all that was Steve, right? And Steve's a very highly gifted being, and he did all the buildings at Lama are beautiful. I mean, they're not very well done. I mean, they rot and fall, but they are... they're done so that the planetary configurations, the moon falls in the right square at the right time of the Enneagram, you know. And so Lama was built, and it was part of the New Age commune scene, and it really, because of its beauty, and it's awesomely located, you know, up in the mountains with a beautiful view of a valley, and on a very sacred, the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and it had its moment, a great moment, at which the eclectic spiritual movement was very a dominant force. And during that time, many teachers came there and taught. But now consider what happens to the people that are living there, you see. Each time a teacher comes, maybe it picks off one of them, and they become a devotee of that person. So pretty soon you've got a whole group of people living together, but they're not sharing practices anymore. Yeah. So then they share one meditation every morning, and they share circles before lunch. Okay, that's nice. They're still together. But in the meantime, they're very much visible. Hundreds of people are coming to them every weekend, and it's a heavy load on them, okay? Added to it is the karmic problem of the success of Be Here Now. See? And that's my karma that I laid on them. It's not my karma fully. It's theirs too, but... I refused to take responsibility for Be Here Now. See? And the understanding was that the money from Be Here Now would all go to Lama and that they would disperse it for spiritual purposes. Right? Well, there were a number of spiritual projects that it was dispersed for initially. But then as the years went on, more and more the income kept coming because Be Here Now kept selling, more and more until it now appears that 70% of the incredible amount of royalty income, which is adds up to $388,000 to date, 70% has ended up supporting the Lama community. Right? They're living and they're building programs and so on. So they built a center called the ISC, which was the Intensive Study Center. And the plan of that was that a teacher could come, a spiritual teacher from some metaphor or other, bring their own students, have a totally protected environment to work for maybe 3 months, during which time that teacher might now and then come over into the community and help everybody else, and they would sort of be doing a service and at the same moment helping that more intensive work go on. Some of them could be maybe the intensive students, but it would be separate but part of the community. Right? They had already built, we originally had a plan for 4 stages of Lama, that Lama would have the communal part, which has the animals and the gardens and the kids and the weaving and the flags and all the book business and all the libraries and all, and the baths and all. Then it would have, higher up on the mountain, would have monastic retreat settings. Then in the town or in some city, it would have some kind of a city manifestation, a store or a restaurant or a school or something. And then because a lama is really an educational institution, that people would go through a kind of a 2-year cycle in which they would spend a quarter of the time in each of 4 different systems, a quarter of the time in the retreat, a quarter in the commune, a quarter in the city, and a quarter in some other metaphor, like going to India or studying Tibetan Buddhism or something like that. And they go through the cycle twice. And then they come out the other end, right? That was originally the plan we had, right? Well, then the ISC got built with Be Here Now funds primarily. A few other funds, but primarily that. Well, in the meantime, Sufi Sam died, and he got buried, Murshid Sam Lewis got buried up at Lama, and so it became something special now in another kind of a way, right? The commune continued to serve the community, and we had these summer programs for a while in which, like, I would come, and Zalman Schachter would come, and various Hari Das Baba would come, and we'd have these big retreats, and they were incredible because that's a great scene to have them in. But it's limited by the water situation. New Mexico has difficult water things, and you can't have hundreds of people on the mountain continuously because of the water supply. In the meantime, the physical plant is built, and Stephen's got all his energy, and he doesn't have a trip like everybody else quite has, you know. And he didn't meet Maharaji, and he doesn't have those kind of things going. And he is drawn slowly, slowly, slowly to Islam. Stephen comes out of a Catholic altar boy background with a very heavy, a lot like Timothy. He's not personality-wise, but there's a similar quality of a kind of a righteous intensity about him, and he's an artist to boot. And pretty soon Stephen is into Islam in a way that is like, we're ready for the Inquisition and the wars again, you know. It's like kill for Islam, you know. He's got the Quran in one hand, he's pretty soon, the women are sitting behind with their faces covered, and the men are wearing headbands, and the whole thing is taking on it's the most conservative Islamic sect that he's aligned himself with, and the thing is getting fierce, and he has taken over the ISC now and made it into an Islamic stronghold, right, until pretty soon there's literally a holy war going on in the mountain between the Basic Study Center, which is saying, with the regular Lama, which is saying, we are a commune of people who are following different paths, and he's coming over and saying, what is all this dancing and singing? And I want curtains put up in the showers so that the women can bathe at certain hours and the men at certain... And he's laying this heavy moralistic trip on everybody over there. At the same moment, they are doing the Sufi, the Islamic trip exquisitely, because everything he does is exquisite, right? So you can't quite knock him because it's a pure trip, but it's... And the idea of the ISC was to be a pure thing, but suddenly it's the Islamic one, and they're not giving it up for anything, right? That's their home, right? So it's a very interesting dynamic, okay? And I think relevant to this discussion and this show, too, whatever show this is. How's our tape? Are we all right? The board has consisted for a long time of people, of David Padua, who's a very beautiful guy, a very interesting guy. I mean, he's complicated too, but David is the guy I went to India with in 1967. He's the fellow that started a company called Basic Systems. He's a genius. And he sold it to Xerox and made a lot of money. And he's just a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he's now living in Santa Fe. And he's got a thing called the Grassland Seed Company or something. And he's doing a huge thing with exporting seeds, grass seeds, for covering deserts and stuff like that to Iran and Israel and all kinds of places and all over the country. And he's becoming a major grass seed distributor. Okay. And he's been on the board. Jonathan Altman, who put in some of the original money into Lama, and who is a Zen Buddhist, studied with Suzuki Roshi, is on the board. Michelle is on the board. Michelle is the gal who runs Bodhi Mandala, which is Suzuki Roshi's Hot Springs retreat in New Mexico. She's a beautiful gal.
Hello, Michelle.
Yeah, I really like Michelle a lot. She's a beautiful gal. And those three were on the board. And Zalman Schachter was on the board. And a couple of other people, I guess. Well, I never would go on the board, because I said I don't serve on boards. But this year, the battle got so heavy that, and I got so many appealing letters that I finally decided at the annual meeting, I should go to the annual meeting. Also, what happened was, a year ago, last fall, I looked and I realized that that Lama was in a very heavy space, that Stephen was running it wild. There was a personality war going on. And it didn't feel right to me that the Be Here Now money, which had something to do with Maharaji and therefore was in some way entrusted to me, should all just go to feed this war and keep these people on the mountain to just play out this thing. So I wrote and I said, I know I legally turned everything over to you, but I'm asking now for half of it now to go to the Hanuman Foundation for us to distribute for spiritual purposes and use the way we think it ought to be used. And they in effect wrote back and they said, a few of us would like to do this and agree with you, but some of us don't, and the place works by unanimity, and so since it's not unanimous, nothing's going to happen. So that was interesting. That took a few months. And then I wrote another letter, and I said, well, I'm going to say it just once more. I'm going to review the whole thing, and I'm going to tell you that I think morally you ought to do this. Legally, I have no bind, but morally, I think you ought to do it. But I'll never say a word about it again. This is the last letter, and if you don't agree, it's okay. That'll be it. I'm not gonna stop loving you or anything. You know? Yeah, there's a bit of history here that I got to point out. In '74, after I was at, I think it was the same summer I was at Naropa. I've lost it now. I taught at Lama also. That was the last time I taught at Lama. And then, because Stephen's scene was already getting so strong, and he was so disruptive. The first seminar, the first retreat that was ever held at Lama was held in 1969 when I came there in the fall and ran a retreat. It wasn't the first retreat, but it was the first winter one where we started to heat the places and all that. And Stephen was so disruptive in that one because he was so threatened by my being a teacher that I had to throw him off the mountain, right? And there was a tremendous drama about that, okay? Out of that came the agreement to do Be Here Now between us. By the way, after I threw him off the mountain, he came back to, he could come on to go into retreat because I had it set up so that everybody did 8 days of solitude in the retreat. It was a 7-week thing. And he could come and do the solitude, and after the solitude we met and we had a real, like a Steve Gaskin thing, a real knockdown, drag-out thing, and out of it came the agreement to do Be Here Now. But I said to him, Stephen, I've got to say one thing. And this is another flashback. Back in 1965, Stephen and I went on tour together and rapping around the country. We did different lectures up in Oregon and so on. And he made the advertising, and he made the 96 or 99 Names of God, which is this beautiful mandala of the names of God, but he did it yellow on yellow, so you couldn't read the whole thing, and you couldn't read where the lecture was or anything, right? Because artistically it was beautiful, but it had no functional value. So I said to him, Stephen...
We're familiar with that.
You're familiar with that. So I said to him, Stephen, I love you and I want you to do the book and you're incredibly creative, but I'm going to control, make all final decisions, including artistic. Well, boy, he'd never allowed that ever before, but he knew the book was going to be fun and they were going to have five artists work all winter at Lama and so on. And so, Be Here Now was a beautiful collaboration. There was never a problem. There was never a time I had to veto or anything. There was joy in the whole thing, all the way through. Okay, so 74, I did the seminar. I said to them before it, I said, in order for me to create the space I need there, everybody's got to agree to accept me as the teacher during the time I'm there. And if they're not, they should leave the mountain. So Stephen led an entourage off the mountain, right, rather than accept me as a teacher during that time. And some of the people stayed on to accept me as a teacher. So after that, the next year, Stephen didn't want to leave, so I wasn't invited to come back. So I didn't come back to Lama. Okay. And that's been the way it's been. So this time I went back for the annual meeting because so many of them said to me, look, you're like an elder brother. This is a terrible fight. Come and help us in this fight. So the meeting was incredible. I mean, if you want high theater, the thing between Steve Gassman was nothing compared to what this was. In a dome where hundreds of people can dance, there is the whole gathering of the permanent members. Bhagwan Das is there. The whole crowd has come from everywhere. Saul from Rainbow Bridge. The whole group is a big gathering of people. Stephen and his entourage are all sitting on a rug facing Mecca with headgear and all this stuff. They're coming on. You can swear. It's like Lawrence of Arabia. You're sure the horses are outside the door chomping at their bits, playing in the desert sands, waiting to ride off. It's like an old biblical scene. It is incredible. So what had happened was, I went there, and I didn't go to get the half of the Be Here Now money, but I went there merely to be a brother and see if I could help. Also, I was merely there in order to let that issue be relevant, okay? However, I wasn't really that attached. It was one of those issues where it was in balance. There was a balance of all of it. So the meeting was exquisite, and it went on all day. And the result of the meeting was that Stephen wouldn't allow any new permanent members to be elected because it's unanimity. The board wouldn't agree to change the laws of unanimity. So it ended up that we couldn't really move. There was no way. He had blocked every movement of the whole organization, right? But he wanted to go to Mecca. Okay. Problem was that if he left for Mecca, immediately the whole thing would change, right? So the result is, at any rate, that he has left for Mecca now with his current wife. And we have put on new permanent. I've gone on the board. We've put on new permanent members. I'm going to teach there next summer. The ISC has been given to the Islam for another year, the Islamic community for another year, but there is a new Islamic leader coming in to run it. Stephen can come back, but then he's got to deal with a new Islamic leader, and he's got to deal, and I've been living at Lama, working with all of them, working about the next year's program in the winter and so on, because the problem is that all that money from Be Here Now made them sloppy as a commune because they never figured out how to live because they always had so much money. And now half of it they gave half of it to the Hanuman Foundation. They just did it all on their own, even while Stephen was there. Stephen then said he wanted the book withdrawn. He wanted the book off the market completely. He wanted Be Here Now stopped because it said that the Bible was an astral storybook. I said, well, that isn't a put-down. That's merely a statement about form, right? No, he thought that was derogatory and he wanted the book taken off the market. So we've made a compromise. Hanuman's taken over the publication of Be Here Now. It's no longer published by Lama Foundation. Right, half the royalties go. Stephen was in a peculiar position because he was living off the money of Be Here Now, right? And yet he was putting it down. So he was very vulnerable in many, many levels. Okay, so what we plan now for next summer is when I look around, I look at the letters I get, most of the time people are saying, how do I live my daily life in a way that works, that is useful to my awakening? I know how to get high. I know how to go to satsang and to meditate and all that. I do that. But when I have to go to the same job every day or I have to deal with the kitchen or the toilet, how do I work with it? Which is karma yoga. And we've never really, really gotten down to it about karma yoga, to my satisfaction. I've never done it personally, let's say that. I don't know about we, but I haven't. And I know I've helped a lot of people deal with this. The prison project, in a way, is like that. So I've suggested that Lama Foundation become like a karma yoga institute, in which, like, I'm going to come there for 2 weeks, and then and Brother David is going to come there for a while. He's beautiful. And because he's a beautiful karma yogi. And I'm asking that every teacher that comes there focus their teaching about how all of their methods and practices will focus on the issue of karma yoga. How do you do things in a way to become conscious? Like, for example, doing tasks you don't want to do, and working with the third Chinese patriarch. Just the lines, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And just take that as a mantra for the day, and then be assigned to a task you don't want to do, and just keep working with that, and working with it, and working with it. Just a whole lot of devices. Evening meditations, all that stuff too. But focus. And then the Catholics do it one way, and the Sufis and the Islam will have a 2-week seminar there. But the whole thing will be focused on karma yoga. Okay. So I'm hoping that Lama will develop this identity, and I'm going to try, instead of bringing my own staff in, as I usually do, I'm going to work with the staff that's at Lama. We'll all become teachers together. So that's what I've been up to at Lama.
So you'll be working with someone from a variety of disciplines one time or another.
Yeah, well, I'll only be there for a couple of weeks. Uh-huh. But they'll all be there.
Be interesting.